The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in this Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wish Christians would have a better sense of humor instead of getting so freaked out whenever programs like Saturday Night Live do satire about Jesus. Yes, a recent Saturday Night Live skit mixes Jesus Christ with Quentin Tarantino in a satirical movie trailer for a film called "De Jesus Uncrossed." The spoof starts with Jesus rising from the dead, pushing aside the boulder that blocked his burial tomb with a devious smile. He utters the words, "Guess who's back?" What follows is a vengeful killing spree against the Nazarene's enemies, including his Roman executioners and the traitor Judas Iscariot. Well, public reaction was swift and predictable. According to the Los Angeles Times, some are calling this the single most offensive skit in Saturday Night Live history. One reader in the LA Times commented, "Any Christian who finds mocking Christ is funny has never read the Bible and is ignorant of their own religion. If you do not understand history, you are doomed to repeat it. Prejudice and persecution grow from apathy and mockery." Televangelist Pat Robinson described the Saturday Night Live skit as an example of anti-Christian bigotry that is just disgusting. Okay, look, as a Christian, I have often felt that my fellow believers need to lighten up a little. Everything is susceptible to humor. In fact, when Monty Python's Life of Brian came out years ago, I was one of the few Christians who defended the film. To me, it was hilarious. I saw little evidence that the filmmakers were trying to be sacrilegious. Laughter and the getting of laughs seemed their only motive. What, then, is the problem with Saturday Night Live? Because there is a problem, and I can describe it in just two words: double standards. Don't hold your breath waiting for Saturday Night Live to make fun of Muhammad. You see, they're smart enough to know that staying alive is more important than ratings. Even if they were spared a fatwa, the directors might be in danger of imprisonment from the Obama administration. Such was the fate of an Egyptian-American who made an unflattering video about Muhammad, only to discover that our First Amendment no longer has any teeth. Fortunately, some Christian leaders were smart enough to point out Saturday Night Live's hypocrisy rather than merely expressing disdain. Penny Nance of Concerned Women for America said, "Today, SNL would never have the nerve to mock Islam as it did Christianity. They would never be brave enough to run a skit mocking Muhammad at any time, let alone during Ramadan." Pat Robertson made a similar comparison. He said, "If this had been a Muslim country and they had done that and had Muhammad doing that stuff, you would have found bombs being thrown off and bodies on the street." Well, ever since 9/11, Islam has become the pet religion of America's politically correct. The popular spin is that this otherwise peaceful religion has been unfairly hijacked by a few nutcase terrorists who have misled us into thinking the Quran actually commands jihad. Actually, the Quran does issue such an order. Surah 9, "Prophet, make war on the unbelievers and the hypocrites and deal rigorously with them." Now, people argue otherwise and insist that such passages are taken out of context, but the actions reveal true beliefs. Who are we kidding? The reason people treat Islam with awe and respect is that they are afraid of Muslim retaliation. No such fear exists for Christianity. Ironically, those who feel the freedom to ridicule Christianity unintentionally compliment the religion. Nobody expects the Pope to issue a fatwa. Neither can they imagine a group of nuns bursting into NBC studios with machine guns or vacation Bible kids learning how to construct bombs during arts and crafts. In fact, the only thing that makes Saturday Night Live skit funny is the absurd image of a peaceful man like Jesus doing violence. Now, Christianity does have a checkered history. The Crusades, the Inquisition, various wars of early Protestantism are nothing to brag about. But for most of these examples, we have to reach back for centuries. And we see in these events behavior clearly contrary to Jesus' teaching. He did not want his gospel spread by force. When he was arrested, Simon Peter pulled out a sword, cut off the ear of one of the men arresting him. Jesus said, "Put your sword back in its place, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword." Christ's followers are commanded to offer the gospel peacefully. Those who choose to convert do so voluntarily, not out of fear. So not every humorous depiction of Jesus is blasphemy. As long as other religious figures are also fair game, that doesn't mean, by the way, that Saturday Night Live should feel obligated to show Muhammad doing violence. It wouldn't be as funny. It wouldn't look so unusual. Muhammad, after all, really did that kind of stuff. And he commanded his followers to do likewise. Now, before you write in, before you call in, I know, I get it. Some people believe in a second coming of Jesus in which he returns as a warrior to set up his kingdom. That is going to happen someday. But future prophecies about Christ were not placed in Scripture as cues for Christians to justify violence. On to other news, although this one should not be news. The news is more about our media than the story they are reporting. It happened almost 2 weeks ago, and people are still talking about it. What was the most important news to take away from President Obama's State of the Union address? Are people talking about his desire for even more taxation? Hunger showing no signs of ever being satiated? Are they wondering if the boasted progress of his administration exists only in delusional minds? Are they concerned that he got away with both incompetence and lying over the Benghazi incident? And that it would have been nice, albeit unexpected, if he offered some kind of explanation that Tuesday night, since the death of an ambassador does say something about the state of our union? No, the real news of the evening was far more riveting. During the Republican rebuttal speech, Senator Marco Rubio actually stopped to take a drink of water. Wow. Circle the wagons. This is the most colossal headline of all time. Who could sum it up better than CNN? They ran a video of Rubio drinking his water above a caption which read, "Career Ender." Career Ender. This would be laughable if it wasn't so sad. One might think the caption itself would end the career of CNN journalists. They don't exactly come across as reincarnations of Edward R. Murrow, do they? If anything, this incident makes a case for radio over television. PBS was forced to actually talk about the speech, or NPR, PBS's radio affiliate, I should say, because without distracting pictures and images, people are forced to actually ponder a man's words. And Rubio had some good things to say that night, such as this. He said, "Raising taxes won't create private sector jobs. And there's no realistic tax increase that could lower our deficits by almost $4 trillion. That's why I hope the president will abandon his obsession with raising taxes and instead work with us to achieve real growth in our economy. The idea that more taxes and more government spending is the best way to help hardworking middle-class taxpayers, that's an old idea that's failed every time it's been tried." Rubio went on to say, "More government isn't going to help you get ahead. It's going to hold you back. More government isn't going to create more opportunities. It's going to limit them. And more government isn't going to inspire new ideas, new businesses, and new private sector jobs. It's going to create uncertainty." Look, folks, those are powerful words, but not powerful enough to erase the image of him stooping and moving to a smaller table where his bottle of water sat. Now, true, one must wonder why Rubio's assistants didn't place the bottle a little closer on a taller table. And yes, the reach was both awkward and distracting, but one drink of water should not create a whole sea of tabloid sensationalism. If people paid a little less attention to minuscule matters and more attention to the actual message of Rubio and other conservatives, they might learn how to decode that smooth language called Obamanese. They would understand that bipartisanship means doing things exactly Obama's way. They would see that investing means wasting more money, usually on a lot of green companies like Cylinder that are going to just, die the death they deserve to die. They would wonder why our president has learned absolutely nothing from the last gargantuan stimulus that went belly up like a beached whale. They would realize that a higher mandatory minimum wage means that employers who cannot afford to comply will simply hire less people. They would realize that Obama's promises to dodge Congress by two magic words called executive order, which he bragged about in his State of the Union message, well, that may sound like a heroic president who merely wants to get things done, but it's really reminiscent of Augustus Caesar finding ways around the Roman Senate, the result of which heralded a new reign of tyrant emperors. Those who laugh at Rubio's drink of water should look at themselves in the mirror and face the fact that they, too, have been drinking something. They've been drinking in President Obama like an intoxicating wine instead of listening to him with a critical ear, which is supposed to be the job of the news media. And they need to ridicule somebody like Rubio because they can't answer his actual arguments. They take too much sense. But I'll tell you who's a greater threat to liberals than Rubio. And if you haven't heard this name yet, you're going to be hearing a lot more of it in the near future. The name is Dr. Benjamin S. Carson, pediatric neurosurgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital. He gave a history-making speech at the recent National Prayer Breakfast. The speech has set the media into a buzz. It has also gone viral on the internet. Carson's words were controversial for two very important reasons. First, although Carson is an African-American, he renounced the political correctness embraced by today's liberal African-American leaders and challenged many policies of the Obama administration. Second, President Obama himself was sitting in the audience listening in the front row. Oops. Regarding political correctness and the free speech challenged by this dangerous movement, Carson spoke with refreshing frankness. He said, but PC is dangerous because, you see, this country, one of the founding principles was freedom of thought and freedom of expression. And it muffles people. It puts a muzzle on them. And at the same time, keeps people from discussing important issues while the fabric of the society is being changed. And we cannot fall for that trick. And what we need to do is start talking about things that are important. We'll talk more about this challenger, another African-American leader, just as good of a speaker as Obama, except that he actually has something to say. We'll be right back.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Dr. Benjamin Carson, an African American was guest speaker at the latest national prayer breakfast. Obama was sitting in the front row, listening to his own policies denounced. Cutting against the grain of Obama's tax and spending policies, Carson said, "And one of our big problems right now, our deficit is a big problem. Think about it. And our national debt, $16.5 trillion. What about our taxation system? So complex, there is no one that can possibly comply with every jot and tittle. When I pick up my Bible, you know what I see? I see the fairest individual in the universe, God. And he's given us a system. It's called tithe." Now, when he was talking about a tithe, 10%, that might have been a hint to suggest a flat tax system. Moving on to the topic of health care, Carson offered a solution that will never be confused with Obamacare. He said, "Here's my solution. When a person is born, give them a birth certificate, an electronic medical record, and a health savings account to which money can be contributed pre-tax from the time you are born to the time you die. When you die, you can pass it on to your family members so that when you're 85 years old and you've got six diseases, you're not trying to spend up everything. You're happy to pass it on, and nobody's talking about death panels." Now, although Carson's family background certainly had many obstacles to overcome, Carson explained why he does not view himself as a victim. He says, "I had a mother who would never allow herself to be a victim, no matter what happened, never made excuses, and she never accepted an excuse from us." While Carson spoke, oh, go on YouTube and take a look at Obama's face. To say that it was somewhat solemn is the understatement of the century. The speech should have put him to shame, but that would suggest that he has a sense of shame. It's more likely that his anger was being aroused, yet controlled. After all, public speaking and a usage of the bully pulpit is Obama's greatest advantage. At the National Prayer Breakfast, he found himself in the presence of another orator just as gifted, only this man offered words that could genuinely unite our country instead of ripping it apart with class warfare and gender race division. You know, at the 2004 Democratic Convention, Obama won the admiration of many because he did seem interested in unity. He said, "There are no red states or blue states, just the United States." Yeah, that sounds great. And yet this same man has added a pack of matches to the already heated divisions of party, class, gender, and race. He explains most of our country's economic problems with one familiar refrain: the rich need to pay their fair share. He's also called Republicans the do-nothing party, even though they passed a pile of jobs bills that were dead on arrival at his desk. And who could forget the war on women that Obama's surrogates keep talking about? As for race division, Obama played that card before he even became president. While he was running in 2008, before he even won, he says, "They're going to try to make you afraid of me. He's young and inexperienced, and he's got a funny name. And did I mention he's black? Oh, that's bringing us together, Mr. President." It seems our country had no problem after all about electing an African-American president. But history would have been better served if it had been a man like Benjamin Carson instead of Barack Obama. Maybe that'll still happen in a future election. The subject was actually broached by Sean Hannity of Fox News. Hannity was especially impressed with Carson's speech. He invited the doctor for an interview on his program February 8th. Toward the end of the segment, Hannity asked Carson if he would consider running for president. Carson said, "If the Lord grabbed me by the collar and made me do it, I would. It's not my intention to this," Hannity replied. "I would vote for you in a heartbeat." How often have we heard the simpleton theory that conservatives such as Sean Hannity object to Obama only because he's black? Anybody who wishes to embrace such pea brain thinking needs to explain why Hannity would try to talk an African American into running for the highest office in the land. For that matter, explain why Herman Cain was so popular with the Tea Party. Explain why conservatives rushed to the defense of Clarence Thomas. Certainly, racism is a horrible chapter of our country's past, and yes, it still exists. But for the most part, Americans have moved on despite the fact that liberal leaders try to keep the division alive along with other potential conflicts. The time has come to admit that the soul of our nation is not being fought for in the context of race, gender, or class. The issue, sweet Virginia, is values. If you'd like to weigh in on any of this, of course, the phone is always an option, but many people reaching us through the internet, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, S-I-E-G-E-L.net. You can also follow us through Facebook, Twitter, one of our regular listeners, Peter in Maine, writes me, and he says, Bob, I am forwarding a copy of an email I just sent to the Department of Homeland Security in Washington. I thought it might be something you would like to see and perhaps talk about in the politics portion of your show. The email is pretty much self-explanatory, and here's what Peter wrote. He said, hello, I'm a very concerned U.S. citizen, and I need someone to answer some specific questions. Yesterday, I found information regarding DHS and other federal agencies that is very disturbing. I have verified most of the information I found, so I am not getting upset over rumors. I have attempted to reach your offices in Washington, D.C. with no success. I either get disconnected or lost in a jungle of automated menus and voicemail. What I have learned is that DHS is purchasing a large quantity of shooting targets for agent law enforcement training that depict, among other things, elderly citizens, children, or pregnant women with a weapon in their hand. These targets are being purchased from Law Enforcement Targets Incorporated. They are called No More Hesitation Targets to train and desensitize law enforcement in the shooting of ordinary citizens. I am very concerned about the DHS apparently training and preparing their officers to fire upon U.S. citizens. I would like someone to explain exactly why the DHS is doing this. I am not interested in any vague or boilerplate type of explanations. It is unconscionable that the DHS is essentially planning on shooting its own citizens, especially the vulnerable types of individuals, pregnant women, children, the elderly portrayed in these targets. I have seen the actual vendor's website selling these targets, and the information that DHS is purchasing a large quantity of them is reliable. I fully expect a satisfactory explanation of this issue, or I will be forced to contact other agencies in Washington for further assistance in getting that response from your agency. Thank you, Peter. Well, that's harrowing, Peter. Let us know what you find out. I had not heard any of that. Peter's exchanged information with me for a number of years. I know he's somebody who's not into conspiracy theories. He's pretty level-headed, but that was based on his research, not mine. But I'm interested to see what he uncovers. As we know, we do have U.S. drones shooting upon U.S. citizens in Afghanistan and places like that. And of course, there are terrorists who will give bombs to children and old ladies. So it's interesting to see the direction that our country is going. But this idea that Americans can be assassinated even if they're just suspected of terrorism, that much we know. So I have to say that if what Peter's describing is true, it wouldn't surprise me. But we'll keep an eye on that. We'll see what he finds out. Okay, other things that we talked about today regarding Marco Rubio's drink of water. Larry on Facebook says, instead of investigative analysis leading to objective reporting vis-a-vis Edward Murrow, today's liberal media resembles a high school cheerleading squad enamored with Obama's style, clueless as to substance. This person calls herself Krinken. She says, true, the media focuses on some silly things sometimes. However, if they had focused on his actual content, I think it would be worse. America is not going to vote for a president that does not have even a basic understanding of science. Now, I am with him on the tax issue, but seriously, is this the best person the GOP has to offer? Well, what she means about science is that Marco Rubio had said he believed in the Genesis account in the Bible. Krinken, this may come as a big surprise to you, but there are many scientists, people who know a lot more about science than you do, and they believe in the God of the Bible. Go figure. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, WNS takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for WNS Electric Incorporated, license number 480-539, WNS Electric. Back to our program. I've been reading some responses to some of the ideas I shared in my monologue. We don't do the news every week on this program, so sometimes when I get to it, I have to catch up. And we were talking about, although they are still talking about it, it is still in the news, all this chitter chat about Marco Rubio taking a drink of water in the middle of a speech. And amusedly responding to my points, I love these names people give themselves on the internet, amusedly. Oh, if only their comments were as amusing as they think. Amusedly says, you make a good point about style over substance, but never having read any of your columns before, I wonder if you complain as much against the unending buffoonery displayed by the Fox News networks on a daily basis. Well, my friend, since Fox, unlike the other networks, shows both sides, has both liberal and conservative viewpoints pretty evenly, you'll hear me complain about some of them and not others. I have no problem with the hard news division of Fox. I certainly disagree with the viewpoints of the liberals. But I do find that network more balanced than MSNBC's Chris Matthews, who got a chill up his leg listening to Obama talk. Yeah, that was objective journalism at its finest. Concerning Dr. Benjamin Carson and the column version online of my thoughts, Think says, very interesting. I am also a naturalized U.S. citizen from Latin America and hold very similar views. Liberals have done an amazing job at equating conservatism with racism in the minds of millions. The result, an incompetent individual gets a second term as president of the United States because he happens to be black. Well said, my friend. Mike says, I don't know much about Dr. Carson, but I was impressed by his speech. It has become very rare to hear logic coming from behind the political podium anymore, except, of course, from libertarians, but the media pretends they don't exist. Nick says, great article from beginning to end, particularly the issue of race and politics. The reason I don't like Obama has nothing to do with his race. In fact, if Hillary or Kerry were president, with the same disastrous results in the last 4 years, I would have disliked them even more than Obama. By the same token, if Dr. Carson or Condi Rice ever decide to run for president, they will be my first choice. Not only are they highly qualified for the job, but they have the capacity of flushing out the racial venom that has been building up in the last 50 years and allowing our great country to reach true color blindness. Very well said, my friend. Regarding the Saturday Night Live skit about Jesus, Betty and Patty on Facebook like what I have to say. Teddy on Facebook says, yeah, I saw this. Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do. Yikes. Tony on Facebook doesn't have a problem with the skit, but agrees with me about the double standard. Tony says, freedom of speech is so important. Parody, criticism, lampooning, sarcasm, etc. is a necessary freedom in our society. Protecting the right to your own point of view is fundamental and helps to define America. We don't need thought police. There are double standards in our society and hypocrisy, and that's good to point out as well. Open forum for discussion brings a possibility for understanding and peace. Now, this person calls himself DB. A DB refers to my online column version saying, how ironic that you mention hypocrisy at a time when the teachings of Christ have been twisted to justify the hate-filled rhetoric of millions in this country. Christ teaches us to love our neighbors, not ostracize, judge, or condemn them. I'm pretty sure Jesus is much busier trying to understand their hypocritical use of his message rather than the words of a few misguided comedians. Besides, God has a sense of humor. If you don't believe me, look at his duck-billed platypus creation. Well, DB, my article took no issue with Saturday Night Live's sense of humor, which you might have noticed if you had actually read the article instead of merely reacting to it. And yes, there are many hypocrisies in the name of Christianity, but you listed no examples, but I think I can read between the lines. And I'm almost positive you're referring to the fact that Christians articulate moral standards, such as their views against same-sex marriage. And supposedly Jesus has nothing to do that because it means we're not loving our neighbor. Listen, Jesus had standards and Jesus taught morals. The fact that Christians articulate moral standards as found in the Bible is not hypocrisy. It means a group of people are being consistent with what they actually believe and what Jesus truly taught. You see, Jesus didn't just teach what we imagine we think he would have taught. We have a whole record of his teachings. Eric quotes where I talked about the fact that Jesus told Peter to put the sword back in its place, and he points out another place where he thinks Jesus did justify violence. He goes to Matthew chapter 10, verses 34 and 35, and he quotes Jesus saying, "Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword, for I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law." Then he goes on, and the only reason more humor is not aimed at Islam and Muhammad is the fact that a great portion of his followers are violent. Oh, really? You think you're pointing that out as some kind of revelation to us, Eric? No kidding, Eric. Thank you for pointing that out. The reason people don't attack Islam is because it's violent. Okay. Eric continues, "It's not a double standard. It's common sense. It's like if I had an unhinged, violent neighbor to the left of my house, one prone to violent outbursts or a history of violence, and to the right, a neighbor that, well, maybe annoys, thinks everyone is treated better than they are, cries victim at the drop of a hat. Well, they are rarely, if ever, the victim, but is not a violent person. Guess what? I will tread lightly with my dealings of the neighbor on the left." Okay, first of all, let's go back, Eric, to what you said about Jesus and the sword. When he said, "I've come to bring a sword," he was speaking metaphorically. We do that all the time. We do that with our football games. Beat them, massacre them, cream them, kill them, slaughter them, murder them. All we mean is that somebody's going to win a game. You have to laugh at the fact that people spoke metaphorically in those days too. How do I know for a fact that Jesus didn't mean that literally? Because when Peter literally picked up a sword, when Peter actually drew a sword, Jesus told him to put it away. So it was a metaphor, and we have to look at Jesus' words in context. He was saying families will be divided in ancient Israel over him. And that still happens today. I was born Jewish, but disowned by my father after converting to Christianity. What Jesus predicted is quite true, and it's happened in my life. As for Muslim violence, the violence of Muslims should not be catered to. If people would stop rolling over and playing dead, perhaps some of the terrorism would subside. And all you did, my friend, was illustrate my point. I said it's open season on Christianity because people do not really fear Christians despite all the belly aching about them. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
Kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that he is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. educateforlife.org.
That beautiful music that you're listening to right now is from the sound, from the soundtrack of Phantom of the Opera. We like to bring a little culture to this program. And the music you heard before we went to the break is from Les Miserables. Now, I've been playing that as staple music, bumper music on this show for years. But we have rotating bumper music. We don't play the same set every week. I went out of my way to make sure Les Miserables was played today to commemorate, even as I talk, and most of you are probably watching it instead of listening to me right now, the Academy Awards. All to say that next week we are going to do our annual Academy Awards show with film critic Mark Boobie. And now you're thinking, well, Bob, you usually do that the same night as the Academy Awards or the week before the Academy Awards. Why did you decide to do it a week later? Well, that's because whenever Mark and I did it a week before or the same night, we couldn't resist making our dumb predictions about what was going to win and what wasn't going to win. This way we don't immediately date the show. When we do it next week, it'll be a done deal. We'll know who won. We can talk about who we thought should have won. That doesn't mean I can't make a dumb prediction this week, though, before the show. Next week's show will be saved for posterity. I do think Argo is going to win Best Picture because Argo makes Hollywood the hero, and Hollywood likes to view itself as the hero. So we'll see if that happens. But whoever wins, we will talk about all nine of the Academy Award nominees, or as many as we can, on next week's program for Mark Boobie. So I know you don't want to miss that. In the meantime, on this week's program, I'm wrapping up some response over the internet to some of the things I was saying in our monologue today that I started off with about the Saturday Night Live skit, mixing Jesus with Quentin Tarantino. And this person calls himself Heart Feathers. He says, if the Christians would just shut up, there would be no anti-Christian bigotry. A religious zealot without a sense of humor equals a terrorist. You know, in my monologue, in my article, right at the beginning, I went out of my way. What did I say? I said, I think my fellow Christians need to lighten up. And these guys who claim there's no anti-Christian bigotry are themselves such anti-Christian bigots that they just don't even catch that I said that. Well, let me say this to you, Heart Feathers. I already said that Christians should have more of a sense of humor. But your statement, a religious zealot without a sense of humor equals a terrorist? That is just about the most thoughtless, irresponsible comment I have ever heard. It waters down real terrorism, takes the sting out of it. Do all religious people without senses of humor fly planes into buildings or slit the throats of stewardesses or behead people? You should be ashamed of yourself. Well, let's stay on the topic of Jesus and theology now and go to the Bible. And this is a message that I do, maybe as often as once a year on this show because it comes up a lot. If you made a list of the top 10 questions that people ask about Christianity, this is way on the top of the list. How can a loving God, who's all-powerful, also allow suffering and evil in the world? Now, there's a verse in the Bible which actually promises that Christians are going to go through trials. I wish I had seen that verse early on in my Christian walk. I had been a Christian for 3 months. When my dad discovered I was a Christian, I was still living at home. I was in college, but I was living at home, going to a junior college, commuting. And my dad found out I was a Christian, and he disowned me. And boy, my first reaction was, God, why is this happening to me? I'm just trying to follow you. I'm just trying to obey you. All I did is ask you to forgive me my sins. But of course, over the years, in the name of Christianity, some horrible things have happened to my people, the Jewish people. So the outrage is very understandable. You would think that a father would at least take the time to sit down with his own son and hear his point of view, but my dad didn't take it that way. Took it very personally. thought I did it to get back at him, thought I hated him, thought all these things that weren't true. And suddenly I was disowned, pronounced dead, kicked out of the house. That situation never changed. My dad, over the years, never spoke to me again. He passed away early in the year 2001, and we were never reconciled. But here's a passage which, if I had been aware of it at the time, it would have added some comfort, because I was continually going before God saying, why is this trial happening to me? And look at these words. You'd think they were written just for me. And they were written just for me, and they were written just for you, because we're told that the Bible is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword, in Jesus' metaphorical usage of the word sword, not literally. 1 Peter 4:12-13. Dear friends, do not be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering as though something strange were happening to you, but rejoice that you participate with the sufferings of Christ so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. Now, the Bible does tell us why there is suffering in the world in general. The Bible does not tell us why it's proportioned the way it is. The Bible tells us that because of our ancestors, Adam and Eve, the first human beings, were given a paradise. They didn't appreciate paradise. They were curious to know what evil was, so they found out. When we return to paradise, when we return to heaven, we're not going to be curious about evil anymore. We will have learned our lesson. The Bible does not answer every question of life, but it tells us where we came from, where we're going, and a little bit about how to live in the meantime. That's not too bad. That's not too shabby. So it is because human beings turned from God and said, we don't want anything to do with you, that God withdrew himself from human beings, withdrew himself from the world, and that left the door wide open for these evil creatures who fight God, demonic spirits. And boy, okay, maybe you don't believe in demonic spirits, but there are many people who've witnessed them, who have experienced them, who have encountered them. I am one such person. So what can I tell you? They exist. I understand that it sounds weird, but just because something sounds weird, that doesn't automatically mean it isn't true. God withdrew himself from the world. Evil took over this world. So we are told, in a general way, why suffering and evil exists. That's what the Bible does tell us. What the Bible does not tell us is why evil and suffering gets proportioned the way it is. Why does a little girl of 6 years of age die of leukemia while a mobster lives to be 80 years old? Why is one person confined to a wheelchair while somebody else can walk? The Bible does not answer those questions. But we do have some principles about suffering in general. And whenever somebody brings this up and asks you this question as a Christian, you want to start with empathy, because usually the person who asks about this is not doing it for a philosophical, theological exercise. They are probably going through some kind of trial, through some kind of pain in their own life. So be empathetic. But then the next thing we want to point out, and this is one of those making the obvious obvious things, people act like this is an exclusive problem with Christianity. Like somehow the suffering and the evil in the world challenges the Bible's God, but it challenges no other God. Is that true? Well, I'm going to show you how that's clearly not true when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net.
if God is such a loving God, how come there's suffering and evil in the world? First of all, this is not a unique problem to the Bible. Whatever religion you are a part of, you may be a Christian, you may be Jewish, you may be Muslim, you may be a Hindu, you may have some agnostic view of God, you may have some deist view of God, you may believe in some kind of force, whatever your belief about God, whoever this God is, this God has some reason for allowing and not interfering with the suffering and evil in the world. How do I know that? How do I know that for an absolute fact? Because there's suffering and evil in the world. It's pretty apparent. How does this become a unique problem with the Bible? It's a problem for all religions. When my dad disowned me for becoming a Christian, my dad's brother, my Uncle Norman, my favorite uncle growing up, took me out to Denny's to try to talk me out of my horrific decision. And it was sad because it didn't go too well. He broke down and started crying right in the middle of our lunch, asked how I could stab my father in the back. And then he did something which a lot of my Jewish friends do and Jewish relatives. He brought up the Holocaust. Now, the Holocaust is an interesting thing to bring up because the Bible does tell us that human beings have a part of their nature that's evil. And yet humanism and secularism says that human beings have been morally evolving. Well, the Holocaust happened in the middle of the 20th century and did things that would have made emperors Rome look like Candyland by comparison. So the Holocaust is a great illustration that the Bible's assessment of human nature is true. But Jewish people like to bring up the Holocaust sometimes when they're talking about Christianity. And of course, there was horrible hypocrisy. Some of the Nazis that ran the concentration camp called themselves Christians and went to church. Okay, look, going to church no more makes you a Christian than sitting in a garage makes you a car or swimming in the ocean makes you a fish. So there are people that go to church who call themselves Christians. Jesus said early in his ministry, many hypocrites will follow me and call themselves my followers, and I'll send them to hell on judgment day. So if you have a problem with Christian hypocrites, you have more in common with Jesus than you realize. He hated religious hypocrisy. But anyway, Uncle Norman was bringing up the Holocaust, and he said to me, and I'd heard it before, he says, where was your Jesus when 6 million Jews were killed by the Nazis? I said, Uncle Norman, do you believe in God? He got very defensive. He said, of course I believe in God. I said, where was the God you believe in when 6 million Jews were killed by the Nazis? Where was the God of Judaism? Where was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Of course, I believe that the God of the Old and New Testament is the same God. But you see my point? It's not a unique problem to Christianity. And then he said, well, maybe I don't believe in God. I said, okay, maybe you don't. But any belief in God has this problem. This is not a unique problem to the New Testament. Now, people say, Bob, why couldn't God do something about suffering? You know what's interesting to me? I told you that this is in the top 10 list of comments, of objections to Christianity. You know what another one is in the top 10 list? How could a loving God send people to hell? Do you realize that those two concerns contradict themselves? On one hand, people are saying, I can't believe in a God who, as far as power goes, is virtually impotent, who sits back and doesn't interfere with the world, sits back, watches evil go on, does nothing. But then they turn around, change gears, switch gears, and they complain about the fact that the Bible says, well, actually, God's going to do a great deal about the evil in the world. He has a day called Judgment Day, and after we die, our bodies and souls will resurrect, stand before his throne, and he will send many people to hell. On one hand, they're complaining that God does nothing about suffering and evil. On the other hand, they complain that the Bible says he's going to do something about it. I talked to a policeman one time. He said, two problems I have with your God. I don't believe in a God who would send people to hell, and I don't believe in a God who would allow the evil that I've seen as a police officer. And I reminded him of the time when we had met. I came home late from work one night. And he was there right next door to my house because the lady who lived next door had called the police. Her husband had beat her, and evidently this had been a pattern. It had gone on before, and her husband was in the car drunk, yelling, screaming, cussing, kicking at the windshield, handcuffed, yelling, let me out of here. And the policeman pleaded with this woman. He said, ma'am, would you please, please, please press charges this time? It's always the same. Your husband beats you, you call the police, we come to your house, we arrest him, you come down to the station, you drop the charges, we have to let him go because you dropped the charges, he beats you again, we arrest him again, you drop the charges again, we let him go again. He says, we've gone through this 7 times. You're making my job very difficult. One of these days, you're going to end up dead. Your husband is dangerous. He needs to be locked up. I said, sir, when I saw you say that to the woman, I didn't say to myself, oh, what a horrible policeman putting this poor man in jail. I said, what a compassionate police officer who cares so much about this woman that he's pleading with her to let him protect her. If God let murderers and rapists and drunkards into heaven, it wouldn't be much of a heaven. So yes, God is going to do something about all the evil in this world. Now, the problem is all of us are evil. Or I should say all of us have an evil side of our nature. We're not completely evil. The Bible calls it our sinful nature. And what God did is understanding that part of our nature is like that. He came down at a certain time in history, became a man, and he died and paid the penalty for our sins so that we would never have to. So you could say that long ago, God did something about evil. Evil is a result of sin. God took the sin, killed the sin, destroyed the sin on the cross through Jesus Christ. Now you say, well, why can't God do something more than that? Why doesn't he just wipe out all evil? My friend, if God wiped out all evil, none of us would be here. You want him to start with you? See, we usually mean everybody else is evil when we say, why can't God wipe out all evil? What he did was he died on the cross to forgive all of us who have committed the evil. And then on Judgment Day, those who have accepted Christ will be forgiven. Those who have not accepted Christ will go to hell and will pay for their evil. So rest assured, God will deal with evil quite drastically, quite ferociously, quite finally. And then you go, okay, Bob, well, all right, maybe he couldn't wipe out all evil, but couldn't he at least restrain it a little bit? He does. He restrains it through his spirit. Things would be so much worse if it weren't restrained. We're told that the day's going to come when his restraint is taken away and things are going to be more evil than they've ever been. That's called the seven-year tribulation. But in the meantime, human beings have free will. God didn't create us as marionettes on a string. He didn't create us as robots programmed by a computer forced to love him. God didn't put a love potion in our drinks forcing us to love him against our will. God gave us free will. Evil is not something you create. Evil is not a substance. Evil is not something you look at in a test tube. What God created was neither good nor evil. He created human personality in his image. Now, that doesn't mean we look like God. That doesn't mean God has fingers and toes. It means spiritual image. Like God, we think, we feel, we create. We have sentience. We have free will. And the ability to do good, unfortunately, includes the ability to do wrong, or it's not a real ability. Years ago, on the Donahue Show, Billy Graham, the evangelist, was a guest. And Donahue, kind of the king of all the afternoon talk shows, he asked Billy Graham a very interesting question. He said, do you believe there's life on other planets? And he thought Billy Graham was going to be so closed-minded, because, of course, all Christians are closed-minded. So Graham's answer actually surprised him. He says, I don't know. There's many galaxies out there, and there are all kinds of planets that haven't been discovered. Maybe there is life on other planets. Well, Donahue was quite taken by this. He said, well, how would that relate to God? If somebody came here from another planet, would that mean that God doesn't exist? And he says, well, there's only one God. If somebody lives on another planet, they have the same God we do. And then Donahue asked a very interesting question. He said, would these people have to accept Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior to be saved? And Billy Graham said, that all depends on whether or not they fell into sin. And he says, well, what do you mean by that? He says, well, I'd like to believe that there's human beings that maybe never fell into sin, and they don't need Jesus as their Lord and Savior because they were just always with Jesus, and they never fell into sin in the first place. At this point, Donahue goes, wow, if that's true, that makes me feel kind of gypped and ripped off that I was born on Earth. It would have been better if I was born on another planet. I'm unhappy about the way I was born. Why doesn't God do something about that? And then Billy Graham said, if you're unhappy about the way you were born, maybe you should become born again. You see, that's what this is all about. God is giving us a second chance. We may have inherited a mess from Adam and Eve that we didn't deserve, but Jesus led a righteous life, and the credit of his life is transferred to our account. the sins we've committed are transferred to Jesus' account. That's something we don't deserve either, but it's an act of mercy. And so a loving God has done something about the evil of the world. Are you concerned about the evil of the world? There's a paradise waiting for you out there someday, and it can begin now. You can give your life to Jesus Christ. We'll see you next week.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.